So the Charter says, now I know that you all love to know that there are two. Okay. Are you on Thursday? Okay. So I think we will also send an email to remind you, and please try to spread out the word for those of you who couldn't make it or couldn't make it to the room there. Okay, so we'll continue with Philip today.
Right. Just to emphasize, the second question sheet will be posted on the website either today or tomorrow morning. So just look for it. And it's just a couple of questions. With lots of parts. Okay. That's one of them. Okay, so last time I tried to try to address this very big question of what does it mean to understand quantum theory. And I identified the sort of a part that I think is really fundamental, which is forming a conception of reality that's so clear that when mathematized, it naturally gives rise to the quantum modeling framework. And then you ask, well, what is the obstacle? What are the obstacles in our way? And one of the obstacles is simply that the mathematics of the quantum theory, the quantum modeling framework, has many features whose physical origin isn't clear to us. And this makes it difficult to focus our conceptual energies. And the reconstruction of quantum theory, which is what I want to talk about today, has as its goal precisely to remove this obstacle, ideally to have a set of physical assumptions and to show that the mathematics of quantum theory can be derived from them. So just to recap, what needs to be explained? We need to be able to explain why states are represented by complex vectors and not some simply real vectors, and why dynamics are represented by unitary transformations and not simply by any length-preserving one-to-one maps. And measurements, why are measurement outcomes subject to the Born rule? Why this particular mathematical form? So that's basically what we have to explain. As someone very astutely pointed out to me at the end of the last lecture, these two questions can be considered really as one, as just a single question. So the quantum formalism says that states are represented by complex vectors like this, and transformations by unitary operators. Let's just look at the simplest case here. Okay, so we have a complex vector. These are complex numbers, and this is a unitary transformation, so these are complex numbers. And what we can do is we can just, if we want, there's nothing to stop us rewriting all of this in purely real form. Okay, there's nothing to stop us doing that. And if we define this as, so you've got A, B, C, D are real numbers. Okay, and if you just construct the vector A, B, C, D, which is real and its length is 1 according to the Euclidean norm. And then you just say, well, B dash is equal to UV. And you just basically expand, if you expand everything out, so basically you'll end up with V1 dash, V2 dash equals the unitary times V1, V2. Okay, so. So using, this is the complex side of things, okay? And equivalently, we can say Q dash is equal to some matrix times Q. What is that matrix? And we can write that down, that matrix, in terms of the real and imaginary parts of these complex numbers. And when you do that, and it's a bit of algebra, which I won't do here, but what you find is that this matrix is a rotation matrix, which is quite nice. And it's not just any old rotation matrix. It's a very specific type of rotation matrix. So we can reduce the, this sort of explains what I was trying to say. You can combine these two questions into a single question, which is, okay, we have no problems with representing a state like that. That's as natural as you could imagine. But then those two questions collapse down into the single question, why is the transformation between, why is this transformation matrix a rotation matrix? Or why is it that very special kind of rotation matrix? Okay, so this we can think about the mathematics in different ways. Now, in this lecture, I'm going to try to convey a sense of the diversity of the approaches that exist to try to reconstruct quantum theory. There are something like 10 to 15 approaches of which I'm aware, some only vaguely. And they use a very wide variety of mathematical languages. So it's very difficult it's practically impossible in the space of a lecture to go into all of them and to give you a sense about all of them. So what I'm going to do is actually just give you a sense of how many there are and give you some sense of what they try to do, what they take as a given, and how far they succeed, and then go and give you an example, which I will work out quite carefully, and show you the kind of things that we get out of it. So recent approaches, and by recent I mean the last 25 years or so, more or less starting with the work of Will Wooters. So very crudely categorized the approaches into three types. I mean, you could categorize them some other way, but this is quite helpful. Some people have tried to construct a general probabilistic framework, which is called a convex state framework, and basically then impose certain axioms on that framework, which seem to be physically well motivated. And from that, trying to pick out quantum theory. So the idea is that you have basically quantum theory is a particular kind of probability theory. And this has been pursued, for example, by Lucien Hardy here, and John Barrett and Matt Leifer, who are also here. And there are many others. I should say that Hardy's work is trying to actually derive quantum theory very specifically. That's the target. The work of the others here is not so much trying to target the quantum formalism per se, but trying to derive particular properties that we know that are particularly quantum. For example, no cloning, as I mentioned last time. For example, they show that no cloning is quite a generic property of probabilistic theories. It's not something that's that generic, that specific to quantum theory. And then there's another group of approaches where the concept of information plays an absolutely crucial role in their thinking. This group here, Wooters, Sumhammer, Bruckner, and Zeilinger, they all ask themselves the question, if I've got some physical system in some state, which I don't know, and I do measurements on that system to find out what that state is, if my measurement doesn't tell me everything at once about what the state is, then how much does it tell me about the state? And as I do more and more measurements, how does the information I have about the state build up gradually? So they analyze that in quite some detail and come up with some very interesting structure. And what I will be talking about is largely based around here. And then there are others who think about information in a different way. Rolick and Popescu seize upon one of the very striking things about quantum theory. You've already heard about non-locality, so that you know that there is this this breakdown of this assumption of locality from classical physics, or this idea that's a desirable feature of physical theories. But nonetheless, you also know that you can't use entangled pairs of particles to actually send signals from each. So in other words, if I have an entangled pair of particles and I give one to you and you go very far away and we do experiments locally, we know that the correlations between our measurement outcomes can't be explained in terms of the local hidden variable theory. So there's some kind of non-locality there. On the other hand, I can't do measurements on my system and thereby instantaneously transmit information to you. Quantum theory doesn't allow that either. So you've got this strange coexistence, and Avner Shimoni, a philosopher of physics, describes it as a peaceful coexistence between special relativity with its principle of light as an upper limit to the communication of any kind of information from place to place, and non-locality on the other hand, these correlations that we're seeing. So what they do is they pick on this point of astonishment, so to speak, this amazing thing that you can have these things coexist. And they try to turn that round and use it as an axiom. Say, okay, let's assume that reality is like that. Do we get anything like quantum theory as a result of requiring that? So this is the style of thinking that they are using. They manage to show that it's not by any means strong enough to give quantum theory. They're able to show that you can have much stronger violations of the CHSH inequality and yet still preserve no signal. So it didn't work, but it didn't give rise to the desired result. But it was a very stimulating idea, and it's led to some other approaches, including something Clifton, Butt, and Halverson. So this is a much more recent approach, and they do something kind of similar. They say, well, we'll assume there's signaling, and they assume that there are a couple of other informational tasks which are not possible in the physical world, and they try to derive quantum theory from that. Another type of approach is to think of quantum theory as a kind of variant of probability theory. And that idea is inspired by Feynman's rules, basically, for the combination of amplitudes. So last time I talked about the path integral approach, I just sketched it very, very quickly. But the heart of that is that how you combine, if you've got say two paths that are possible to go from here, from A to B, and you have an amplitude for each one, the total amplitude to go from A to B is A1 plus A2. And if I can go from A to B via C, then the total amplitude to go from here to here is just that amplitude times that amplitude. So in other words, if you've got successive paths, one after the other, you multiply amplitudes. And if you've got parallel paths, you add the amplitudes. And these are known as Feynman's rules for generating amplitudes. You can read these straight off the von Neumann mathematics that I wrote up here, just writing it in a different way. So, but the thing is that these rules look very close, very similar to the sum and product rules of probability theory. And what Tkaczynski and Katicha noticed is that you can derive the sum and product rules of quantum theory from some very general consistency arguments, which I won't go into here. It's far too much to talk about in this time. But Cox, a physicist in the 50s, showed that you could derive the laws of probability theory without appeal to the concept of frequencies, just as probabilities as numbers, which quantify your degree of belief in something. So what they try to do is adapt that mathematical derivation to amplitude, and they're able to derive Feynman's rules for adding amplitudes. Okay, so what's the negative here? Well, the negative is they had to assume the idea of an amplitude, and they had to assume that it's a complex number to begin with. So that's an input. But if you take that as a given, then by consistency conditions, you can derive Feynman's rules, which is quite nice. But it's not ideal, but it's nice. It's a step forward. And just to make a comment here, so Clifton, Bob, and Halverson's work, they claim that they're able to derive many of the key aspects of the quantum modeling framework, but they take as a starting point something called a C-star algebra, algebraic framework. And this is an abstract mathematical framework where, in particular, complex numbers are the basic part of the structure. So their work has been, in that sense, somewhat criticized by foundational people as, well, kind of assuming far too much at the outset. But nonetheless, it's a powerful and interesting piece of work. These approaches, sort of these two here, they assume a very minimum of abstract structure, virtually nothing more than probability theory. And likewise, this one here. So what you have here, I mean, I'm just giving you a very quick, and there are many other approaches as well I haven't mentioned, but just give you a sense there's a very wide range of starting points in terms of physical ideas that are picked upon and said, okay, let's run with those, see where we get. People differ very heavily on whether they assume almost no abstract mathematical structure to begin with, and those people are who feel willing to sort of assume things, big mathematical assumptions to begin with. And they vary also in what they manage to achieve. So for example, these approaches don't claim to gotten very, they haven't gotten very far in terms of getting a quantum formalism, but this one they claim to have done, and likewise Katich's approach, and likewise Lucien Hardy's approach. And I just mentioned here, I mean, a list of references you can find in this paper here. It has an introduction of a couple of pages and lists references to most of these papers. So if you're interested in exploring any of these, then that would be the place to go. Some of these papers are remarkably accessible. I mean, they're not difficult at all. They're totally within your grasp in terms of if you're interested. They're not mathematically sophisticated. They're just because we're at a stage in reconstructions when what we need is clear ideas and very careful working through of them. So it's not at the level of it isn't at a sophisticated mathematical level. The only thing which is here is the Clifton, Bob, and Halverson work because of this C-star algebraic framework that they use. So let me now talk about a particular path to reconstruction. I think this is quite a nice quotation by Chris Fuchs, who's a long-term visitor here at PI, about what reconstruction is about. The task is not to make sense of the quantum axioms by heaping more structure, definitions, science fiction imagery on top of them, but to throw them away wholesale and start afresh. We should be relentless in asking ourselves, from what deep physical principles might we derive this exquisite mathematical structure? So, I mean, this is an example that has been mentioned quite a few times as a model of reconstruction. In other words, when we look at physics as we have it now, is there any other example where we've had some mathematics which looked like it had some fundamental meaning, but we couldn't figure out what that meaning was, and then somebody came along and did just what I'm saying, kind of formulated some physical ideas and showed how you could derive the mathematics from those ideas. And this is exactly what Einstein did with the Lorentz transformations. So the Lorentz transformations at an abstract sort of mathematical level can be just thought of as the symmetry group of Maxwell's equations. They're the things that you can do to Maxwell's equations that leave them invariant, just as Galileo's transformations are those things that leave Newton's laws of motion invariant. So the problem is this set of transformations conflict with Galileo's. Okay, so this is the problem. And if we take Maxwell's equations seriously, and then therefore these transformations seriously, it does suggest that there's some kind of fundamental conflict between these two theories. And the natural question is, well, what does it mean physically? Okay. And what Einstein did is that he basically showed that you could derive these transformations from two postulates, which you know very well, the constancy of the speed of light measured in different inertial frames, and the principle of relativity, which comes from Galileo already. And very critically, he defined time very carefully. He rethought what does it mean to say, to talk about time and clocks, measuring time. So he did away this idea of a universal clock that, and our little clocks in our laboratory somehow sense that universal clock and just somehow access it, right? So he worried about that and realized that that wasn't, if we had speed of light as a kind of universal limit to our, the propagation of, the speed of propagation of information, then we had to rethink what we meant by time. Even if there is a universal clock, we have to think about what we mean by time as measured by our clocks. And, okay, I've lost some slides here. So the postulates of, the two postulates here, now, okay, so you have to ask the question, why is it that this was accepted as a good reconstruction? And so in what sense was it a good reconstruction? Well, the first postulate, the principle of relativity, is something that was already well, conceptually well-founded and was already formulated by Galileo. It's an invariance principle, and a theoretical principle, which is an invariance principle, it is very much accepted amongst physicists as a very good kind of theoretical principle to hypothesize, because it basically allows us to compress vast amounts of distinct physical information into a simple set of equations. The second postulate, which is the constancy of the speed of light, as you know, is something that, you know, it's experimentally well-founded. So it was basically an extrapolation or a generalization of experimental facts. So in that sense, even though we might not intuitively understand the constancy of the speed of light, nonetheless, there's a sense in which we know that it does seem to be a good description of how nature works. It does seem to be, because we find it to be experimentally. So in that sense, it's a good reconstruction. And it raises the point that a reconstruction doesn't have to use assumptions which are readily apparent to us, that it must be like that. It's okay if we use assumptions like the constant speed of light, that they not be intuitively obvious. The understanding can come later, so we can reflect philosophically on what these assumptions might mean and build up an understanding later on. So I think of reconstruction, I think a good way to think of it is a kind of a middle, like a stepping stone to a clear conceptual understanding. You take, for example, in this case, Lorentz transformations, which look very abstract. We don't really understand them. You find some basic features of the physical world, either experimental or theoretical, that you're willing to believe in, that you think are very well founded. You derive the mathematics from those principles. And then later on, you can form a conception of reality that somehow makes it seem very natural and reasonable that those assumptions should hold true. So that's the two-step process. So, okay. So in the case of quantum theory, what we want is a strategy for reconstruction. And so Einstein, he picked upon some basic features of reality and he took those as a given. So what are we going to take as a given if you want to try to reconstruct quantum theory? Well, one thing is that we look at the things that quantum theory and classical, the quantum modeling framework and the classical modeling framework have in common. And last time we saw that, that they have in common many things, like the idea of time I should say, the idea of a system and a background. Can you see if I write here? Is that up to here? Okay, great. So basically, this is the idea that you can partition the universe into a system, its background environment, the thing that it really interacts with, a measuring device, and the rest of the universe. So this is like kind of an assumption too, that you can do that, and it makes sense to do that. So that's kind of like a very fundamental assumption. So that's shared by the classical modeling framework and the quantum modeling framework as commonly understood. So then the idea of time, the idea of state as some mathematical object S, which is in some state space, and that state S is basically a list of real numbers, which could be, you know, there could be uncountably many of these as well. Okay, and we need that for things like describing the electromagnetic field. And so you have a map from state space to itself, which is 1-to-1. So these features are in common with classical, these are common features. And it's something that these are something that we understand. We feel that we understand what this is saying about reality. So there's nothing to stop us. But I think it's quite sensible to be conservative and at the outset just accept all of these things. Okay. One might be unhappy and say, well, should I really be assuming this? Because we know that this kind of gives us trouble when we're talking about quantum theory. But we've got to start somewhere. So let's try to do this. I mean, in a practical sense, in our laboratories, this does make sense. So we get into philosophical difficulties when we talk about the wave function of the universe and things like that. But when we're talking about down-to-earth experiments, this actually does make sense. We do know when a measurement has been performed and so on. What features aren't in common? Well, number one, So there are some common features, and there are some differences. And I haven't listed all of the differences. I mean, you also have things like non-locality, non-contextuality, no, not contextuality. I mean, one can, if you remember, last time I talked about properties of the quantum modeling framework. Well, you could take your pick. There are just so many non-classical properties that you could pick on. So, you know, what do we do? Which do we pick? How do we proceed? Now, here comes the art of doing this kind of work is basically having an intuition about the world and having an intuition about which of these things is the most striking, astonishing, surprising, and which of these, if we take it into account. It's liable to take us some way towards the quantum formalism. The interesting thing about these is that, I'll explain what these are. I realize some are not that familiar. This is obviously fine, isn't it? That measurement outcomes in quantum theory are only statistical. I mean, just to make sure that we understand everything, I'll just say that we've got Born's rule, which tells us. So I'm thinking of. And this is in the Schrödinger picture. In the abstract picture, we can say this similar thing. Now, the interesting thing here is, so I've listed number two. One of the striking things about quantum theory is that you can do experiments on elementary particles and actually find that the number of possible outcomes is finite, can be just two. I mean, that's not a situation we ever encounter in classical physics. So if I have a Stern-Gerlach experiment, are all of you familiar with the Stern-Gerlach experiments? Yeah? Great. So when you do an experiment like this, so you have some source, which is an evaporator. And you have, say, your silver atoms here. And you send it through a Stern-Gerlach device. And this can be oriented at some angle. I'll just say that, you know, it's oriented with respect to spherical polar coordinates, some angle theta and phi. And let's suppose this is just vertical, it's fixed. Well, it doesn't matter what I do to theta and phi. I only ever see a particle in this area or this area, which is really incredible. I mean, we have nothing like it in classical physics. We would imagine that as these change continuously, perhaps the peak might move continuously. But basically, that all the electrons are bunched together over here and over here. And the way we abstract this is to say, well, it looks like there are really only two outcomes. Two, even though, of course, these peaks have finite width. And you could say, well, no, there are still a continuum of possible outcomes, and you'd be right. But what we do is abstract this from this and say the width of the peaks is due to noise or due to some experimental contingencies. The fundamental reality is that somehow there are only exactly two possible outcomes. Now, that's a very non-classical idea. Where there is continuity is in the probabilities. So we find that the probability of finding a particle here changes continuously as we change theta, for example. So this is a very striking feature of quantum theory, that it allows this kind of thing, where a measurement can only have two, say, two outcomes, or three outcomes, or four outcomes. So that's what I mean by that. And complementarity, some of you asked me last time after the lecture what I mean by that. And I should have made that much clearer, because it's really very basic. Let's go to the Schrödinger picture. I can write the wave function as I can just break it into a real part. And an amplitude, a magnitude, and phase vector. I can always do that because it's just a complex. It's just a complex number, complex function. Now, what the Born rule tells me is that when I make a measurement of position, what I actually learn about, what I'm sampling from, is this probability distribution. So what I'm But psi squared is just r squared. So when I do this position measurement, I'm only seeing this part of the state, this function, not this function. So my position measurement is only seeing half of the degrees of freedom in the state. And now, you know that once I measure the position of the particle to be at x sub 0, so let's suppose I measure it at x equals x sub 0, now the wave function is changed, and it takes on, we express it mathematically as saying it takes on the form of a delta function with a very, very sharp, you can think of it as a very, very sharp Gaussian around x sub 0. Well, now there's nothing here in this function about phi. That is useless to do any more measurements on that. If you know, you will learn nothing more about phi by doing more measurements on it. So in other words, by doing a measurement of position, you've committed yourself to learning about this at the expense of this. So complementarity is expressing the idea that, well, roughly speaking, precisely this, that when you make measurements on quantum systems, you kind of commit yourself to learning about half of the degrees of freedom, but not the other half. And then by doing more measurements on the system, on the same system, you can't learn anything more. So you're kind of committed. Whereas in classical physics, for a particle, you can measure its position, and at one time, measure its position a tiny time later, figure out its velocity, so you know the position and the velocity, no problem. Okay, so that's what essence of complementarity is. And you can do exactly the same thing in the abstract formalism. And non-locality, you know very well, you know about that, that there is an inequality that we can write down, and we can show experimentally that it's violated modulo some experimental loopholes. And so it's something that stands independently of the quantum mathematics of quantum theory. We don't, we could do experiments and see that it's violated. So we could potentially take that as a starting point as well. And no non-contextuality, in a similar way, we can do that. But of course, we don't have quantum. But it turns out that if you don't have quantum theory as your backing theory, there are, you can get loopholes. So experimental data isn't enough to actually convince us that this must be true, but it seems very likely. Now, if we want to use any of these things, we want to be able to sort of appeal to something, to say, look, we know that these are true because of experiment, or we think they're really true because of experiment. Just in the same way that Einstein was able to say, look, I know you might think that the constant of speed of light hypothesis is crazy, but there's an experiment to which seems to suggest that is a fair assumption to make. So similarly here, we have to ask, do we understand these in an experimental way? Oh, and the answer is, for this one, yes. I mean, if we do, we don't need quantum theory to tell us that. So if we do this experiment with the Stern-Gerlach, and we get the data, which would be a series of clicks, so we put little detectors here. So we allow atoms to come through, and we get a series of clicks of the detectors. And we say, can we explain that data? What theoretical model should we use to explain that data? Just purely experimentally. Okay. Well, if we do this particular experiment, we find that it looks like that the data is best modeled assuming that it's just like tossing a coin. So it's just probabilistic. There's no correlations between the successive clicks. So that would, those of you who are familiar with statistics, you know that you have these, not just probabilistic models, but you have Markov chains and so on. So we know that those Markov chain type models are not necessary. So in other words, just by looking at the data in your lab, you know that a probabilistic model looks like a very good model for this data. But then you might say, well, maybe I'm getting these probabilities because I didn't do a good enough preparation. Maybe if I put another Stern-Gerlach before this one at some other angle and do a selection, maybe I can get rid of these probabilities. Okay, that's what we would think in classical physics. If we did an experiment like this with classical spin, this preparation wouldn't be good enough to actually make this experiment yield a definite result. But when you're in the quantum situation with the silver atom, that doesn't help you. It doesn't help you. It doesn't change the probabilistic nature of these outcomes. So it looks like experimentally, we really have to accept the best we can do is to accept that data can, the outcomes here can only be predicted probabilistically. Okay. So it does seem that we can experimentally justify ourselves in choosing this and this. These are very basic things. And I won't go into the others, but well, just mention that non-locality is a yes, and no non-contextuality is almost a yes. Complementarity can also be actually seen from this experiment, but I won't go into it. But that one is also a yes. You can actually see, just purely by thinking very carefully through the Stern-Gerlach experiment, that there is a complementarity going on. The phenomenon of complementarity is there as well. All right, so what I'm going to do now is, so what would be the strategy? Would be, let's just take the common features and very selectively just pick up a couple of these and see where it takes us. So what I'm going to do is just do the simplest thing possible, almost, which is to choose statistical outcomes. So I'm now going to say that when you do a measurement on the state, you get an outcome which is determined by the state of the system. And this finiteness of possible outcomes, I'm also going to assume. So I'm going to assume that when you do a measurement, you get one of two outcomes, or one of three outcomes, or something like that, not a continuum of possible outcomes. Okay, so let's write down the state. I will just use different notation now. The simplest thing I could do is to write down the state as that, and measurement on that state yields outcome I with probability pi. Okay, so imagine that now you're given this state, but you're given a system in some state and you don't know what it is, but it's this, and you do a measurement on it. And let's suppose the measurement outcome is one. So what's the state of the system after the measurement is done? Well, we know that reproducibility implies that if I do the measurement, so I don't know if I properly explained this last time, but reproducibility is simply the idea that if I do a measurement on, say, classical system to measure the position and velocity, let's say, and if I repeat the measurement immediately afterwards or very, very soon afterwards, I get the same result. So that's all it's saying. It's a very simple, very basic idea. And it's really important because certainly it's not critical, but it makes life very much easier. Because if you know it's reproducible, then you know what the state is afterwards. So reproducibility means that when I do this measurement again, I must get one with certainty. So the only way that can be is that the state afterwards is that. Trivial, absolutely trivial, but maybe slightly surprising. Because in classical physics, what reproducibility means actually that the state must be the same afterwards. But in this probabilistic modification of classical physics, the state afterwards actually is changed. It must change in order to satisfy this very basic idea of reproducibility. So what does this mean? Well, imagine I've got one system in state P, but I don't know what it is. And I do this measurement, and I get outcome 1. And then I say I want to do another measurement on it to learn more about it. Well, not very useful thing to do, because the state is actually left, it's fixed. The state afterwards is determined by my outcome. So I can't learn anything more about the system by doing another measurement on it. Okay. So if I want to learn more about what that state was before I did my measurement, I actually need to be provided with multiple copies of the system. And then sometimes I'll get outcome 1, sometimes 2, sometimes 1 again, and so on. And after I've gathered all that data, I will get basically frequent. Okay, so imagine that I've taken, let's try the very simplest case where the state is just that. So a measurement just has 2 possible outcomes. Then imagine my measurement, when performed on many copies of the system, gives me M1 ones and M2 twos. If done N times. Okay, so the idea is that somebody gives me N of these things, let's say 100 of them, and I repeat, I do this measurement on each one of them, and I get M1 ones and M2 twos. So after having got that data, a very natural question to ask is, well, okay, what have we learned about the state? Have we learned about what P1 and P2 are? You can see that no matter how many times I do the measurement, I mean, I'm not going to know what P1 and P2 are. The best I can do is to estimate what the values are. So we can ask the question quite naturally, how much information? Does the data provide about state? Obviously the state prior to the measurement. So here we can use probability theory to basically give us a probability distribution over P1. So this notation I'll explain in a minute. So this is sort of notation of more Bayesian probability theory. And what it means is that the probability that P1 has some value P1, given that I observe frequency F1, so I'll define F1 equals N1 over N here. So in other words, this is the data. Let's say about half of the time I got, so this could be a half. If M1 equals M2. This is the number of times I did the experiment. This is my background knowledge before I actually started doing the measurements. Okay, so this is what this notation means. And this is called Bayes' rule that I'm using. Could you give me an idea of how many, not that familiar with it? So quite a few of you are familiar with it, is that fair to say? That just means probability, yeah. So basically, the Bayes rule comes from, it's just the AND rule of probability written in a very useful way. So if I have probability of A and B given C, I can write this as probability of, I'll just write A and B given C. I can use the AND rule of probability. Not clear. No. Okay. Yeah, that's an I. I for information, background information. And just a symbol for what this is. So that's background information, that's the data, and that's the. So basically, what this means is that this equals some kind of distribution over P1. And we want to know what it looks like. So, I mean, intuitively, if F1 is a half, let's say, then what intuitively you expect is that you're going to say, well, I'm very sure that P1 is around a half, it's peaked around a half, but there'll be some uncertainty in what you say. And that the uncertainty will depend on potentially F1 and on N. Okay. So this Bayes rule is just the AND rule of probability theory. So you can think of this as A and B. So it's probability of A times the. So basically, you can take B out and then put it on the right-hand side of the conditional here. And you can also write it as B given A. So I'm just using the AND rule of probability in two different ways here. And when you equate these two things, oh, I should just write it here. You end up with this thing called Bayes' rule. And the reason it's given a special name, you might wonder why do we bother to give it a separate name, is that it's remarkably powerful when you're trying to do this kind of inverse problems. So what that means is that in this case we've got some data and we want to systematically reason about what that tells us about some parameters in our model. And so what we can do is use this formula in the following way. What we really want to know is what is the value of P1 given F1. But we can rewrite using Bayes' rule in the formula to the right. This is like our A. Make sure that's right. Yeah. This is like our B, this stuff. And this is like the C. Okay, so just literally plugging that into the, well, actually, that's my B, that's my C. So plugging this into the Bayes formula, you get, so F1 and P1 switch places. the data, this part stays where it is. Okay, so now because the F1 and P1 have changed sides, this is something we recognize. We can calculate that very easily. That's just saying, what's the probability of getting some frequency, given that we know the probability? So it's like saying, what's the probability that the frequency of heads when I toss a coin will be 2/3, given that the probability of heads is actually just 1/2? And so this is something that we can write down a mathematical expression for. This thing is called, so these have, all of these things have names in Bayesian probability theory. This is called the likelihood. And this is called the prior. And this you don't need to worry about. You can think of this as a, just a normalization constant. And I'm showing you this so that you know that you can actually think through this problem in a completely systematic way using the things that you've learned. So even if this is not familiar, don't worry. What I'm trying to say is that if we want to actually work out this thing on the left, we can do it in a completely systematic way. And when you work this out, what do you get? Well, in general, if n is small, then you're going to get a binomial distribution here. And it's going to be strongly affected by this guy here, which is the prior, which is what you know about P1 to begin with. And in Bayesian probability theory, it's a kind of running problem that we don't know what function to write down for this. What should we choose? Are all values of P1 equally likely, or are some more unlikely than others? So we don't know what that is, but something quite nice happens is if you consider the limit case where n is very, very large, then this likelihood function can be very well approximated by a Gaussian distribution, which is very, very sharply peaked. And when you do that, then over the width of the peak, which is all that really matters, the prior can be assumed to be virtually constant. So in other words, it basically just drops out of the calculation. So in other words, the posterior just becomes proportional to the likelihood. So in that case, okay, so you get something like this. The center is given by the frequency that you measured. So in this case, I'm just saying, let's suppose you measured 0.8 for F1. And then the standard deviation is given by this formula here. And I hope this is, you've seen, at least seen a formula that looks like that. You kind of remember where it comes from. And in the question sheet for this lecture, I lead you through the derivation of this. So you'll get a chance to see where it really comes from. But let's just take this as a given now. Can I just stop and ask if there are any questions at this point? Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so what can we do with this? Well, the question we would like to ask is how much information does this provide? We'd like to quantify. How much information does that provide about what probability P1 is? Okay. To do that, we need a measure of information. We need some way of quantifying the amount of information that we have. And Shannon, who is an electrical engineer, who actually investigated this problem a long time ago, back in 1948, he published a paper on how to actually quantify information. And what he said is, well, actually, he didn't quantify information. He quantified it the reverse, almost, the inverse, the uncertainty. How much uncertainty do we have when we're faced with, say, a coin that has probability of heads equals a half and probability of tail equals a half, and we don't know what the outcome will be? How much uncertainty do we have? And if the coin is quite biased, if probability of heads is 3/4, then we're obviously less certain about, we're less uncertain about what the outcome will be. We're much more certain it'll be heads. So we'd like a way of measuring that degree of uncertainty. And so what Shannon did is, so basically what we're looking for is a function, which is, it's a function of some probability distribution. Okay. Think of this as quite separate from what I've said. So the notation here is also, don't get that confused. And what he did is impose some very, very, very simple conditions on what this function should be. For example, he says that if I add an impossible outcome to this probability distribution, it doesn't change the value of my uncertainty, which makes a lot of sense. That's called extendability. Actually, I should say this is the axioms I'm going to state are by a guy called Kinchin. So these axioms are not exactly the ones that Shannon states. And he says that H is a maximum when the PI are all the same. So let's think about the coin. When probability of heads equals the probability of tails, I've got the most uncertainty about whether it'll come up heads or tails. So that's very nice. And finally, he makes an assumption which is a little bit more complicated. Which is to say that, imagine that I toss, let's say, one coin with two outcomes. And so let's imagine that I have like a compound probability tree. So I toss a coin, and then depending on which outcome I get, I toss another coin. Okay, so I can write down the probabilities for all of these. Okay. And what he says is that if you think of this tree in these, you can think of this tree in two different ways. You could say, you could think of all four outcomes together and say, that's one big probability distribution with four possible outcomes. And I could write down an uncertainty for that. But equally, what I could do is I could think of this as one event, the tossing of the first coin, and then I could think of the second event, as something separate, and I could work out my uncertainty for that. And basically, it shouldn't make any difference. I should get the same number for my uncertainty either way. It doesn't matter which way around I do this. So this is the third axiom. And remarkably, that's enough. I should mention sort of more subtle sort of mathematical assumption of continuity. So as the p's are smoothly changed, the entropy smoothly changes. You find that these axioms actually uniquely pin down the form of the entropy, I should say, up to a multiplicative constant. So up to a multiplicative constant, meaning there can be a constant here. Up to that constant, the form is uniquely determined. And when you want to write down the entropy for a probability distribution over some variable, so now this is a continuous distribution, then it turns out that it looks very similar, except that you've got some function at the bottom, which is called a measure or prior. Okay, so I'm introducing, unfortunately, I have to introduce quite a lot of stuff that if you're not familiar with, maybe a bit much to take in at once. But again, I hope you can see that the basic idea is very sharply defined. The mathematics, the formulae follows from some very natural assumptions. This is pretty well accepted in the relevant fields, that the Shannon measure of information is regarded as fundamental. So can I cover this over now, or still writing? Okay, so using this formula, we can actually calculate the amount of information that is gained as a result of doing this experiment. We can give a number to it. So I'll call this delta k. I'll define this as the uncertainty that we had about p1 to begin with minus the uncertainty that we have about p1 after the data is collected. Okay, hopefully intuitively that makes sense. So I've got a certain amount of, the certain quantity of uncertainty to begin with. And then after my data is collected, that uncertainty has been reduced. And I'm going to define that to be the amount of information that I gain. Okay. And when you work out this, you simply substitute this into the formula down there. You find that this is zero. And this then gives you plus and then it's simply a question of inserting the posterior that we calculated before. So we know what this is. It's a Gaussian distribution. And likewise, this is the same thing as that. And this logarithm you can split out. You can just use the property of logs to say that it's equal to log of this minus log of that. And when you write this, when you work this all out, and again, it's part of one of the homework problems, you get. Mm-hmm. you get a term which goes in log n, and basically you get a term which goes as that. So what happens is that, and this is assuming that this is actually a uniform prior. So we basically can't do this calculation unless we assume some kind of prior here. But if we assume a uniform prior, we get some constant terms, which are, I haven't written. You get a term which increases, which is increasing in log n. So that makes sense. As I make more measurements, I get more information. But I also get a term here which actually depends on what the state actually is. So what this is saying is the following, just talking about it physically. I have some state that's given to me. I make n measurements on n copies of this system, and then I work out how much information I gain about the state. And I actually find it depends on what the state is to begin with. And which seems like, that's not maybe not so surprising. But what I can do is I can redo this calculation and basically say, is there a prior that I can choose, not a uniform prior, but something else, which makes this information gain independent of the state I start with? Okay, just so to run through that again. In this calculation, everything is under control. Everything is determined by some very basic assumptions. The only thing that's free, the only free parameters, so to speak, is the prior. That's the only thing I don't know. That's something that's not fixed by any known principle. So that's the freedom I have. So is there a way that I can choose this prior so that the information gain becomes completely constant? Meaning that no matter what system is, no matter what state it's in, the amount of information I get is the same. And basically you find that the prior that you need is this one here. So this looks very peculiar. So it basically has a minimum here at half, and it goes towards infinity either side. And in probability theory, this has a name. It's the Jeffries binomial prior. So it's something that's known in probability theory. And what we can do is write this in a slightly more useful way, that the prior of a P1, so let's just introduce P2 as well now. So we can write this prior in this form here. So the prior of a P1, P2 is inversely proportional to the square root of the products of P1 and P2. And this generalizes, so you can ask exactly the same question for an n-outcome probabilistic source. So suppose the state is given by probability of p1 through pn. And again, we ask for the prior, which ensures that the amount of information we get is independent of what state actually is. We find that this is the prior that you get. And you can actually show, and this was shown by Wouters effectively, that the average information that you get, averaging over all possible states, is extremized, it's maximized if you choose this particular prior. So from this, we can get two very interesting things. First of all, let's define Q1 equals square root of P1, and likewise for all of them. And when you make the variable substitution and ask what is the prior over the Q's, you find that it's uniform. It's constant. It actually becomes uniform if we change variables. So it means that the following: if we, instead of our state, instead of thinking of our state as being P1, P2, and P3, we switch to variables Q1, and Q3, and plot them like this. So I'm assuming a Euclidean metric when I'm doing this. So a typical state will be something like that. You find that the prior is actually uniform over that surface. Now, this is starting to look a little bit like quantum theory. It's the first point in all of this where we can say that some mathematical structure is arising, which looks like it may have something to do with quantum theory. What probability theory and information theory seems to be telling us is that if we make what seems to be a very simple assumption, you could either say that nature ensures that the amount of information that we get on average when we interrogate an unknown state is actually the best it could be, it's maximal. Or you could say equivalently that the amount of information we get is independent of what the state is. So if we're willing to accept either of those two principles, then the prior over that the state space can be depicted in this very simple way. Okay. Now, if you take probability, the quantum theory, and you just take the real version of that. So these are real numbers now. Then the state, so I've just drawn R1, R2, R3 here. So the state is actually lying, again, on the surface of this sphere, this unit sphere, in this three-dimensional case. And likewise, these are square roots of probability. So when I make measurements on this in quantum theory, it says, you know, if I do it in this basis, it tells you that the probabilities are given by squaring these things. Squaring R1, R2, and R3. So the only difference in the quantum case that is that this V can actually go over the entire sphere. There's no constraint. These can actually be between plus and minus 1. It's when they square them up. When you square them up, they need to be between 0 and 1, but they can be negative. So you end up getting over the whole sphere in this case, but not that case. So we see some structure emerging here. And it turns out that there are other paths which give you the same structure. So using another idea, which I really don't have time to go into now, it's the idea of distinguishability. So you can ask a different question in this case. You can say, you can try to define a distance measure over the space of probabilities. And the distance measure expresses the idea of distinguishability. So a unit if two probability distributions are separated by unit distance, then they're just distinguishable. in a certain number of detections. If you use that idea of distinguishability, you find that the metric over here is the Euclidean metric. So we can say more about it than just that. So where does this leave us? This is just meant to be I just wanted to lead you through a series of steps to see where we can go if we just accept probabilities. What kind of structure emerges? I hope that this has shown that quite a lot of structure emerges that's really not trivial at all. Just by thinking about information, and I didn't get a chance to show it to you, but distinguishability is a very natural idea also, and that leads to a very definite metric over this space. So, and if we do that, the structure that we get here looks somewhat similar, strikingly similar in some respect to what we get in the real version of quantum mechanics over there. What we don't have is complex numbers, and we have this curious discrepancy that vectors here have to lie on the positive orthot of the unit hypersphere, but here, notwithstanding how I've drawn it, they actually can cover the whole of the hypersphere. And the other thing is that we haven't got any kind of complementarity in here. So far, I just accepted the idea of probability. So right now, my measurement can see everything. It can see all of the degrees of freedom in the state. But it's actually possible to bring the next step in the argument is to bring in complementarity and to give that a very definite expression. And the way just to show you how it's done, it's very simple. You basically have a probability distribution like this. And what we say is that, I mean, this is just, you know, making something up to see if it works. So what I say is that when you make a measurement, what you see is P1 plus P2. You don't see P1 and P2 separately. And likewise, P3 and P4, what you see is the sum of them. So you're basically seeing only N outcomes. So that's a simple way, a simple formal way of introducing complementarity. And when you do that, you basically expand your sphere here to a 2n-dimensional sphere. And then using a formal trick, you can actually go over the whole sphere by introducing some binary degrees of freedom. And then using other arguments, it's actually possible to constrain the transformations to rotations of the orthogonal transformations of the hypersphere. And then via a final argument, it's actually possible to recover the complex form of quantum theory. In other words, if you remember, I showed you that quantum theory says that the transformations are rotations, but a particular kind of rotation. So it is actually possible to form an argument that gives you that very specific form of the rotations that are allowed. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is, I'm just giving you a sense, it is possible to complete this story, to actually get the quantum formalism. This is not necessarily the best way or the only way, and this I'm just describing one approach amongst many. Okay, are there any questions? Sorry, it was so rushed at the end, but just wanted to give you a sense the story completes. Oh, great. Thanks very much for your attention. Thanks.